So I'm going to ask you at the end of this talk, even should you be inclined not to applaud, but we'll just have a few minutes of sitting quietly, just to have our own thoughts and feelings, and then we'll finish and go out and have dinner. Celebrating Awakening in the World. That's the title of the talk. And so what I'm going to do isn't so much give an expository talk on the Dharma as remind ourselves what we already know, probably. Reminding ourselves of what the Buddha attained those 2,500 years ago. The qualities of awakening and what impact that has on us here and on the world more generally. What is that impact? And by remembering that impact, hopefully we can be motivated to do the legwork that is required to actually bring those qualities into being in our lives and in the lives around us. There's an old 19th century Tibetan Buddhist called Patril Rinpoche who wrote a piece which I really like. It's called Advice from Me to Myself. And I'm considering this talk as a pep talk from me to myself. And if you enjoy it, then so much the better. So as we all know, from the perspective of awakening, from the perspective of the Buddha, we're living in a state that he called samsara. A state which is characterized by the presence of greed, hatred, and delusion. And that state isn't an external state, it's the state of being that we occupy. Common with 99.99 whatever percent of the human race. And being dominated by greed, hatred, and delusion, to whatever extent, being marked by those qualities makes life very unpleasant for us, and it makes life very unpleasant for the world around us. So I just want to quickly evoke this absence of awakening, the presence of samsara, the absence of awakening, by simply referring to a couple of recent news items that move me. Now, of course, one can multiply examples endlessly, but I'll just take a couple. So I read that there's been a recent trend, a recent spate, of what has become called family annihilations. So this is where, I think it's almost always the patriarch of the family, kills all his kids, or tries to kill all his kids, and sometimes kills his wife as well. And this unhappy event happens sufficiently enough to have this title of family annihilation. It's unusual in the UK. As I say, there's been a recent spate. Apparently there's 10 of these every month in the USA. 10 a month. Another little episode that touched me. This is a local news item. I read it in the local paper. A bunch of con artists targeted some pensioners, selling them a little sort of plug-in energy-saving device, so-called, for £99. They persuaded these pensioners to save them lots of money in energy. They turned that to be fire hazard. It caused a few fires. And then, this is what really kind of got to me, the same con artists, having caused all these various different fires and problems, contacted the same pensioners and posed as being lawyers who would sue the original people for the damage caused. And that just staggered me, the kind of the sheer logic of their greed, the cold logic of their greed. So I don't suppose any of us are engaging in these kinds of practices, but nonetheless, to some extent or another, we are subject to the same forces, the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. And it's obvious that the world would be better if they weren't so rife. It's the cause of all of our problems. And then reflecting on these sorts of problems that go on, I think the usual solution, or the place where most people's minds go, is towards social solutions. You know, what can we do socially to make this kind of thing not happen? How do we educate people so that they don't go and wipe out their family when they get into problems, or how do we educate people to have more empathy? Or maybe legal situations, how do we lock people up more effectively? Even technological solutions. But the thing is, however successful these kinds of solutions are, the same problems are always going to be perpetuated as long as people are born unenlightened. So even if the government could create a universally safe, 100% equitable society, we'd still have the same problem perpetuating itself. So death and dukkha, in particular, they just can't be engineered away. Dukkha is endemic wherever unawakening is endemic. And this is the fundamental problem that the Buddha addressed. The problem of dukkha, the problem of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness. What causes it and how can it cease? So he wasn't a philosopher in the usual sense. He wasn't trying to come up with some great system to explain reality. This was what he's interested in. What causes suffering and how can it end? Thoroughly pragmatic. He likened himself to a doctor, giving people the remedy to their suffering. But he couldn't cure people. All he could do is hand them the remedy. And so ultimately, we are the only people who can have influence on our own dukkha. We have to take responsibility for the suffering as we experience it. And this is the first thing that I want to celebrate. It sounds like a strange thing to celebrate. But I want to celebrate the fact that the Buddha has given us this perspective whereby we renounce the tendency to project our suffering onto the outside world, onto the governments, onto our people around us, onto the system. Whatever it is, he makes it absolutely clear that we are the agents. We are the only people responsible ultimately for our suffering. And of course, there's the first two verses of the Dhammapada that really hammer this home. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. You've probably heard it many times before, but it's worth reminding ourselves. Those are such powerful, powerful verses. So let's celebrate being handed responsibility for our life. It's the beginning of the end. It's the beginning of the path to awakening, and it's the end of the path to awakening, taking responsibility for our mental states in that way. And it's the thread that runs all the way through the path. So what I want to do now is run through some of the qualities of awakening. If you like to sort of polish up their facets, to remind ourselves of their value, so not to take them for granted. It's very easy to start spouting about kindness and wisdom and so on and just lose sight of their incredible value and weight. And what I'm going to do is sort of riff around a framework of that Sangharakshita has been talking about recently, the five principles of the spiritual life. You've probably come across these. It's also been referred to in the system of meditation. I'm not going to try and explain them. If you haven't come across them, it doesn't matter. But if you've come across them, it just gives a bit of a framework. So the first of these five principles, these five ingredients of the spiritual life, which need to be in place to have a balanced and effective spiritual life, is what we call integration. In other words, becoming a whole person rather than a whole bunch of dissociated bits. A whole person that is in some way bringing all of our different psychic forces into relationship with one another. And of course, the great force, the great power of integration is the practice of mindfulness. Now, I don't need to give a big long talk on mindfulness. But It's simply the practice of purposefully being aware, of being able to recognize what's happening in our experience, knowing it for what it is, without being overcome by it. There's an image, I don't know where this comes from, that I quite like. It's the image of, this is what mindfulness isn't. It's like a fly splattered on a windscreen. So normally, we are so caught up with our experience, so caught up with the sights and sounds and emotions that are going on for us, we are completely in the story of our experience, overwhelmed by it to some degree or another. That's like the fly splattered on the windscreen. So somehow there's something about peeling ourselves off the immediacy of the windscreen of experience and getting a bit of perspective on what's going on, knowing our experience for what it is, rather than just being driven by it. And of course, happily, mindfulness is a quality that's already spreading way beyond the remit of Buddhism. Mindfulness-based ... is spreading quite widely through the culture. I want to talk about it in terms of Mara's attack. Those of you who are here this morning, or probably most of you anyway, will know the story of Mara's attack on the Buddha as he was sitting there under the Bodhi tree, trying to gain awakening. So I'll just read you a couple of verses of this. Then Mara commanded his excited army of demons to terrify him, and forthwith that host resolved to break down his determination with their various powers. Some with many tongues hanging out and shaking, with sharp pointed savage teeth and eyes like the disc of a sun, with wide yawning mouths and upright ears like spikes, they stood round trying to frighten him. Before these monsters standing there, so dreadful in form and disposition, the great sage remained unalarmed and untroubled, sporting with them as if they had only been rude children. So usually us Westerners understand Mara as this projection of inner forces that are trying to sabotage our progress towards awakening. It's a kind of psychological understanding. Mara, in this sense, blocks any attempt, or is any force that blocks the attempt to break away from samsara. And there's a great advantage in projecting these difficult mental states onto a kind of Mara. It makes it less personal, less an internal conflict, more of a mythical struggle. A friend of mine was recently going through quite a very, very difficult, powerful struggle. And it really helped him to think of it as being attacked by Mara. That's how he talked to me about it. Mara's really been at it again. And when we read that story of the Buddha just sitting there serenely sporting with them as if they're being rude children, it can sound as if the Buddha was unaffected, or the Buddha-to-be was unaffected. It makes it sound as if, as good Buddhists, we should be unaffected by Mara coming to visit us. But the thing is, Mara did attack the Buddha, or did attack Siddhartha. In fact, he carried on attacking the Buddha throughout his life, throughout his post-awakened life. So something was happening. So what does it mean for Mara to attack the Buddha, or the Buddha to be, and for the Buddha to be unfazed by it? For the story to make sense, there must have been strong, powerful forces going on for that man. There must have been really difficult things going on. But for him to be unfazed, I presume, means something like his mindfulness, his equanimity, was able to contain these powerful forces. Those forces were there, the unpleasantness was there, the confusion was there, the doubt was there. That must have all been playing through his mind, and he could contain those disruptive forces with something much bigger than those forces. He was able to peel himself off that windscreen, so to speak. So what I'm wanting to draw out of this is that don't expect Mara's attacks to be clean and tidy just because we're Buddhists, you know, if we are Buddhists. They are painful, they are uncomfortable, they are disruptive. And we have the capacity, we have the tools to hold them, to contain them, in a way that doesn't spill out, that doesn't create havoc around us, that doesn't deter us from our purpose. So this mindfulness that has the quality of containment, this is it's such a powerful, such an important awakening quality, I'd say. In a way, it's so central that it's really important to give it its due. If we think of these men who annihilate their family, a lot of the time it's because they have had some desperate financial problem. This happened near my family home in Shropshire a few years back. Very, very wealthy man with this huge estate got in financial problems, so he killed his entire family, including family pets and the horses, and burned down the entire estate. Tragic, a tragic lack of the ability to contain Mara's attack, to contain these powerful forces. Apparently these other, quite a few other family annihilations are men who have been left by their wives, or the wives have been having an affair. And so in those cases, the guy kills the kids in spite, to spite the wife. They often send little notes saying, "This is all your fault. You deserve this." Or, "This is a gift for you." You know, the bodies of their kids. Again, it's just such a crazy, tragic waste when all that's needed is this ability to contain experience with mindfulness. So it's just so clear, I think it's so clear that mindfulness, you know, this word that trips off the tongue, has this tremendous power to erode the cycles of suffering. It can erode the cycles of abuse in parenting. I hear so many people who are desperate to stop the cycle of abuse that's been sort of passed down through the family to them. They're determined to contain the emotions rather than spill them on down to their children. It reduces people's frustration that can otherwise spill over into violence. It connects people to an inner source of ethical guidance. And imagine those people who are ripping off the pensioners. If only they had some kind of mindful connection to their inner conscience, then they couldn't have done what they did. And so I'm very excited to hear about the Mindfulness in Schools project, for example, where maybe it will become part of the national curriculum. Fantastic. But how does mindfulness spread through society? How does it spread out? Well, no amount of reading books on mindfulness will do it. It's spread through mindful people. It's spread through mindful people. It's very difficult to resist the mindfulness of someone who's just very clearly mindful. It's contagious, I find. And I'm reminded of a story about... I don't know when I heard this, in the Vietnam War, the two armies fighting each other across paddy fields. Wasn't presumably dug into paddy fields, if it can be dug into a paddy field. Firing across at each other. And then this row of monks just start walking across the paddy field between them, their bowls, into the line of fire. And the fire just completely stopped. Both sides go silent, and these monks just walk between the warring sides. I mean, what a powerful statement. That's something that you can't read about in the book. That has to be experienced. So this is me just trying to exhort myself and you to really treasure the quality of mindfulness, to do everything possible to bring it into our life in a very lived way, a very meaningful way. Because it doesn't only help the people around us, it is, as the Buddha said, the direct path to awakening. So secondly, positive emotion. This is the second of the great principles of the spiritual life. And Sangharakshita and Subhuti in their paper talk about it in two ways. They talk about it in terms of positive emotion, but also skillful intention. So I want to talk about both in a way. I want to talk about Buddhist ethics and the Brahma Viharas, the set of positive emotions. So I recently started reading a book by a guy called Richard Holloway. You may have heard of him. He used to be the Bishop of Edinburgh, wasn't he? And he resigned. Quite a controversial figure. He's apparently an anti-religionist. And he wrote this book called Godless Morality, subtitled Keeping Religion Out of Ethics. So I thought, what a fantastic sentiment. Let's buy that book. And to be honest, I've been rather disappointed with it. Not finished, but I'm disappointed so far. Because the problem is, he had this religious Christian ethic, and now he's saying, let's take religion out of ethics. But what's he left with? He's basically left with a very basic utilitarianism, which means that if your action is harmless, then that's a harmless action. If your action has positive effects, then that's a positive action. If it has negative effects, it's a negative action. It's a rather limited form of ethic, I think. And interestingly, it's limited another way. At one point he's arguing against the Jewish and Muslim conventional morality that prohibits the eating of pork. And he asserts, without any kind of irony, that eating pork is demonstrably harmless, so therefore it is ethically harmless. I mean, that seems like a rather limited form of ethics to me. I'm sorry, Mr. Holloway, but there we go. The reason I mention this is it just makes me realise how precious the Buddha's understanding of karma is. It is a non-religious ethic. But it's just so deep and so wide-ranging and so simple in a certain kind of way. Just recognising that the flavour of consciousness of our future self, so the type of consciousness that our future self inhabits, is formed by the kind of mind states that we act on in the present. So those mind states that we act on reinforce those kind of mind states for the future. I mean, what a simple notion. So if we want to inhabit spacious, kindly mind states, then we act on spacious, kindly mind states. It's as simple as that in many ways. Simple yet radical. So that's all I want to say on Buddhist ethics, is just to really appreciate the understanding of karma that I've got from the Buddha. In fact, I've been using... I wonder if neuroscience is going to prove karma anytime soon. It should be possible, shouldn't it? You should be able to see neuronal connections forming through the way that we act. That would be interesting. So then, to move on to positive emotion. I don't know about you, but it had never occurred to me before learning the Metta Bhavana practice that I could actually positively develop wholesome states of mind, kind states of mind, that could actually affect my emotionality. I just kind of assumed that it's what happens to you, emotionally what happens to you. And learning that we can actually take an initiative with our hearts and minds was a real revelation, and it's one that's that I could do well with reminding myself. So the Brahma Viharas, many of you will come across them, the divine abodes. And they're different versions of metta, of kindness. So we can remember just how radical is the notion that we can actually choose to live in a divine abode. Isn't that fantastic? We don't have to lie down in a divan and be fed grapes or whatever. To live like a god, Brahma Vihara, to live like a god, what we do is apply ourselves with a bit of dedication to a set of practices that the Buddha handed down to us. That's all it takes. The know-how is out there. All we need is the inclination to apply them. And again, if you imagine those con artists spending 30 minutes a week doing the metta-bhavana, they couldn't have done what they did. It just would not be possible, I put it to you. So I just want to riff around the Brahma Viharas a bit. When I do the set of the Brahma Viharas, there's the four of them. When I do the Karana Bhavana, the dwelling on other people's suffering, one of the things that really touches me is that the things that I find difficult and annoying and frustrating in other people, when I come to do this practice, I suddenly realise, oh, it must be really difficult for them to be like that. That's probably exactly what they find difficult about being themselves, or the things that I find difficult about the way they are. And that just really changes my whole attitude, in the moment anyway, to their funny ways of being, their frustrating ways of being. And then looking at them through the eyes of mudita, of sympathetic joy, recognizing not only how open-ended they are, how their potential is completely open-ended and infinite, but in some way, and I'm not even going to try and explain this, how that is inextricably linked to their conditionedness, you know, the conditionedness of, you know, their sort of funny ways of being, at the same time is inextricably linked to their open-endedness. In other words, condition co-production, to, you know, be technical, I suppose, works in both ways. It conditions the way that we are, and it's open-ended. So there's something really unfathomable and unique about people. And using the eyes of equanimity, the wisdom of equanimity, if you like, of upekkha, seeing that inseparability of their conditionedness and their open-endedness, also seeing how their, as in the words of Chogyam Trungpa, their craziness is also their juiciness. Craziness is their juiciness. So I think that upekkha, in particular, and equanimity, is this sort of healing balm, calming balm, that soothes both the tragedy and the excitement of life. It unites mindfulness in its fullness with loving kindness. They're sort of fused into this really potent quality of awakening, equanimity, this fusion of mindfulness, wisdom, and kindness. It's, again, is this capacity to contain experience, but it's sort of gotten a bit bigger now because it's got wisdom in there and it's got kindness in there. It's not a very sexy or dramatic quality of awakening, really, but let's recall that it's the most sublime of the Brahma Viharas. It's the predominant experience of the fourth dhyana, and it's the final factor of awakening. And it's worth remembering that this level, this quality of equanimity, of this sort of wise, mindful kindness, can be taken to levels completely beyond our comprehension. So if you recall the parable of the saw, the Buddha talks about the parable of the saw, so you have to imagine that you've been captured by bandits, and these bandits hold you down, and they start sawing you into with a two-handled saw. Not just a one-handled sword, a two-handled sword. And the Buddha saying, if you have a moment of ill will for those bandits, then you're not a disciple of mine. You're not a disciple of mine. That's pretty heavy, really, isn't it? That's setting the bar pretty high. But this seems to be what he's talking about, this quality of equanimity, being able to hold that level of pain whilst not reacting against the people who seem to be inflicting it. As reminded of another story by Vasantra, you might have come across Vasantra's book, Tales of Freedom, and he talks about a Tibetan, so this is a real story, a Tibetan Rinpoche who comes across a thief who is about to be executed. This is Central Asia somewhere, about to be executed in this particularly gruesome way. They've got this copper cylinder that they call a copper horse, which they stoke up with fire, with wood. They light the fire. This copper cylinder becomes red hot, and then they strap the thief to it. So they don't just burn him nice and neatly, they sort of slowly roast him. And this Rinpoche, when he came across this sight about to happen, walked up and said, "You've got the wrong man, it was me that did it." So they let the thief go free and they execute this Rinpoche. He knows that he can take it, he knows that the thief can't. So moving on to the third quality of spiritual death. Incidentally, spiritual death is not death of the spirit. It is death in the spiritual sense. Some people don't like this phrase. Well, otherwise known as vision. So there's a tradition, probably not historical, but it's a good tradition nonetheless, that the Buddha's first discourse, the first lesson he ever taught to the five ascetics, was on the Four Noble Truths. So in other words, his whole agenda on suffering, what causes it, how to eliminate it. That's really laying out his sort of market stall, if you like. This is what's on offer. I can tell you what causes suffering and how to end it. And the second of his discourses was apparently on the doctrine of no fixed self, of anatta, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. So before I was giving examples of greed and hatred, of these various family annihilators and so on. But what of delusion? Well, from the Buddha's perspective, all of our dukkha is caused by this single root delusion, the way that we think of ourselves as in some way fixed, isolated, independent, actors, and standing behind experience in some kind of way. We've got this kind of common sense notion of ourselves that he says is all the cause of all our problems. And this is one area where the Buddha's contribution is so special, I think. If we think of his threefold path, ethics, meditation, wisdom, there's already an extant system of ethics at the time of the Buddha. There's quite a few different ethical systems going about. It was the time of the Axial Age. There were various different people landing upon a sense of personal ethics. We know that there is a very extensive meditational system around. We know that Siddhartha benefited from learning meditational practices. But what made his contribution so special was nailing this root delusion. He brought this missing ingredient of understanding this root delusion that our basic problem is thinking that we exist in a way that we don't. It's a wrong assumption. The assumption you make about ourselves is a wrong assumption. It's virtually invisible. It's really difficult to get hold of the assumption that we're making, but it pervades all of our actions and emotions, and it creates all of our suffering. It's an over-focus, or it leads to an over-focus on the world out there, on objects out there, and the impact of those objects on a sense of self in here, on the subjective me. And this delusion causes the painful relationship that we get into between the world out there and the sense of self in here, otherwise known as greed and hatred. In a way, all we can know for sure is that relationship. All we can know is that relationship between this world of objects out there that we think are out there and this sense of self in here. What we actually experience is a relationship. We can't directly know the objects outside of our experience. And, well, according to Buddha, try this for yourself, we can't ever find any subject that is in here having the experience, behind the experience having it. All we've got is a sense of relating, a kind of unitary experience, if you like, which we misinterpret. So there's something about this relationship if we can focus in on this relationship rather than getting overhooked on the objects of our senses or overhooked on this sense of ourself that's not getting what it wants, then the world really opens up in an interesting way. I was just playing with that in the meditation earlier. If I just focus on my breathing, then I very easily get distracted, I kind of get knocked off. But if I focus not only on my breathing, but on the quality of attention that I bring to my breath, then things get much more interesting, much more absorbing, and much more resilient. So if we pay more attention to the quality of relationship, then the world becomes very much more interesting, and we gain a tremendous power over the world, so to speak, or over our response to the world. So here I'm thinking of Shantideva in the Bodhicharyavatara. There's a little image which I find very, very potent. And he muses, how much leather would it take to cover the whole world? So you've got the image of the world, of the earth, covered in sort of spiky things and broken glass and uncomfortable to walk on with your bare feet. And he says, how much leather would it take to cover the whole world? And he says, as much as it takes to cover the soles of your feet. If you can cover the soles of your feet in leather, you can walk anywhere. And so again, this comes back to the attitude of taking full responsibility for our response, response to the world, taking responsibility for our relationship with the world. If we can do that, we can go anywhere, do anything in a certain kind of way. And in fact, not only that, but we can really begin to milk the experiences of difficulty. We can, if not enjoy them, we can at least value those experiences. It's a practice that anyone can do. Notice times when you feel slighted, when you feel insulted, when you feel ignored, abused, or even praised. Notice that feeling of a strong sense of self that pops up, that, what about me? Or, hey, what about me? Notice that feeling. Notice that sense of oneself that pops up. This is what the Tibetans call finding the target. Find the target of that abuse. Find the target of that praise. It's very easy to misunderstand the teaching of no fixed self. And this is the way to make sure that you really start homing in on the sense of self that's being denied, if you like. Just find it for yourself. Find that sense of self. Okay, moving on now to spiritual rebirth. So my ill-informed sense of some spiritual traditions is that they stop the spiritual death. They stop with this experience of, if you like, egolessness. This is the end. This is what we're trying to do, just dwell in this experience or non-experience, the ultimate experience. There's a danger of spiritual practice turning into a kind of experience orientation, collecting peak experiences of Vipassana or spiritual death, whatever you want to call it. It's a kind of spiritual bungee jumping. And I think to do this is to miss a whole aspect or a whole orientation of Buddhist practice, which is where we reform ourself, so to speak, based on this new perspective, based on the perspective of seeing through our old incorrect assumptions. We arrive at something that's very much more mysterious. Our self becomes something much more mysterious, much more fluid. In a way, all our self can be is the totality of our experience in any moment. So, vision comes cheap. It's transformation, the path of transformation, the path of spiritual rebirth that follows. That's where the real work, or the real non-work, happens. And I'll talk about this from one angle, what's called the arising of the bodhicitta. So let's go back to the story of the Buddha's life that we heard earlier on. There comes a moment after his awakening under the Bodhi tree where he thinks to himself, shall I teach? It would be awfully, awfully difficult. It's very difficult to teach this kind of thing, to teach this experience I've got, this awakening I've had. And luckily for us, he did. He decided to. For me, that symbolizes the arising of compassion, the unwillingness just to settle down in the dhyanas, in happy absorption, cutting himself off from the world. He decides to go back into the world to communicate. Would have been much easier for him probably just to meditate his socks off. And as an aside, Sangha Rakshita, who started the Tri Ratnam with his community, has also said it would have been very, very much easier for him to have come back to the UK, slotted into an amenable Buddhist community and just been a monk the rest of his life. That would have been much more what he would have wanted. Instead, he spent his life slogging away, really, certainly for the first few decades, herding cats, trying to create spiritual community, which is a pretty thankless task 99% of the time, really. So why bother? Well, it seems as if an inescapable aspect of awakening is compassion, that one can't just sit back and watch others suffer while you're enjoying the bliss of release. There's this urge to communicate. Once we escape the kind of the noise, the mental noise of our own preoccupations, then our energy wants to flow out to help others. And this is the arising of the bodhicitta. It's the heart, the citta, that's set on awakening on bodhi. And it represents a complete revolution in our way of being, in our motivations. I just want to try and bring that out, this inner revolution of motivation. I just had a real flavour of this one, so I'm just telling a little story. I was in Goofy Lake, actually, after getting ordained. I was going through a rough time. I had a week of being quite upset, quite depressed. And I just got to musing my low kind of way. What's the point in living if there's more suffering than joy? If there's more suffering than happiness, why bother living? Doesn't it kind of make it all a bit pointless? You know, that the maths is against me, it seemed, at the time. And I felt this quite strong desire for non-existence. Vibhava Krishna, if you come across this, it's not exactly a kind of suicidal impulsion, but it's just this desire just not to exist. Wouldn't it be easier not to exist? And at the time I was studying the Bodhicharyavatara, this text by Shantideva, which evokes the bodhicitta very, very strongly. And what he writes at one point, this is from memory, I might have got it a bit wrong. All those in this world who suffer do so because of their desire for their own happiness. All those in this world who are happy are so because of their desire for others' happiness. All those who suffer do so because of their desire for their own happiness. Those who are happy are so because of their desire for other people's happiness. And it really struck home as this kind of sudden realization that I've just been operating from an assumption, a really, really fundamental assumption, that life was lived for pleasure. If there's more pleasure than pain, then I'm in the black, life is worthwhile. Otherwise, I'm in the red, life is not worthwhile. And these lines really underline the fact that it's this assumption that causes dukkha. It's this assumption that causes frustration and disappointment. If you can reorientate away from just this pleasure-seeking, then we can take an active interest in other people's well-being as a guiding principle for our action. And then happiness is the byproduct of that orientation. We stop tripping over our own feet all the time. Unfortunately, I can't claim to live by this all the time, but I do know that when I do, then life becomes very, very simple. Life becomes very clear. What has to be done is very simple and clear, and energy can flow. So now I want to lead into the final of these qualities of spiritual receptivity. I won't say much about this. But when there's this radical reorientation of our motivation, then, or as well as, there's a whole change in our perspective of what is and is not worthwhile. Even what life is for. Sangharakshita has put this in terms of the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation, or even the greater mandala of uselessness. And I think this is such a fantastic teaching that it's one that I just want to remember over and over again. So mandala means circle, or let's call it context. So the greater context, or the wider purpose for all of our actions, is ultimately aesthetic, not utilitarian. And realizing this, all of our useful activity is tinged with this spacious perspective. It doesn't mean we stop being useful, it doesn't mean we stop helping, but it's infused with this very spacious perspective, rather than being driven by a compulsion. So we can very simply connect in. We can just remind ourselves of this, connect to that perspective. We don't need the bodhicitta to have ribbon. We just connect with the perspective. Or we can remind ourselves, as Sangharakshita put it, that we don't need to justify our existence by being useful. We ourselves are the justification for our own existence. We are the justification for our own existence. We don't have to earn a right to live in this world. And then, from that perspective, we can relax all those neurotic actions, all those anxieties that are concerned with making ourselves okay in the light, in the eyes of other people, and in our own eyes. We can relax the struggle to feel worthwhile, to feel acceptable, to distance ourselves from other people that make us feel rubbish. We don't have to play pass the parcel with blame, so we feel okay and put all the rubbish onto other people. We can just start to simply be without doing all the time. And what I want to draw out here is the importance of just sitting practice. It's in just sitting practice where we can really embody this perspective. If we don't just sit, we don't just have time doing nothing with no purpose in mind, then our spiritual practice can just be an extension of our other neurotic activities. It's this perspective, I'd say, that is where peace really comes from. And from that perspective, we can add to the sum total of human happiness, whether ours or others, just for the simple joy of it. Okay, finally, what I want to say. We've looked at the five principles of the spiritual path. We've looked at integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and spiritual receptivity. I just want to finish with a quick look at the Sangha. I want to celebrate the fact that we have come into contact with the spiritual life, we've come into contact with the Dharma, and with the Sangha that is trying to embody those qualities. And it's easy to think that of course it was going to happen. Of course I would have come across this movement. Of course I would have come across whichever centre you came across. It's so easy for the Buddhist centre here not to exist. So very, very easy. There's so many people who have put in an awful lot of work over the years, whether raising money to buy this place, putting their life energy into building up this place. And of course, this place wouldn't exist if Triratna Buddhist community didn't exist. It's so easy for Triratna not to have existed. So very, very many people have poured their lives into perpetuating Sangharakshita's teachings, into building up the institutions that we can take for granted. We are all standing on the shoulders of many, many giants who have given their lives to building up these institutions. And of course, Sangharakshita is one of these giants. Imagine the boldness of a man deciding to return from India to the UK and setting up his own Buddhist tradition, not just importing a Theravadan sort of Sri Lankan tradition, not just importing a Zen or a Tibetan tradition, but starting a completely new Buddhist tradition. That takes some guts. And then starting his own ordination lineage. I mean, what a cheek. Extraordinary. And then he stands on the shoulders of many giants, of course, stretching back through the history back to Shakyamuni the Buddha. All these people have devoted their lives to really internalizing the qualities of awakening. And then even the Buddha himself saw himself standing on the shoulders of giants. He saw himself as part of a cosmological lineage of Buddhas. He didn't think that he personally kind of created enlightenment. He just felt himself to have, in a way, been crowned the latest of this lineage. It's as if awakening had been passed down through the ages and is periodically being embodied by whoever happens to awaken. So what this draws out for me is the essential need for the qualities of awakening to be passed down human to human. Not through books, not through podcasts, useful as they may be. Saint Rochester has said that someone who has only read about Buddhism knows literally nothing about it. So the qualities of awakening have to be communicated by experiencing them in someone else. We know this for ourselves, don't we? There's a world of difference between reading about kindness and actually having someone being kind to us. But those two experiences just do not meet. And of course this has implications for all of us. If we value these awakened qualities, it's up to us to embody them for the next generations. And if we want to embody them, then, well, we know what we've got to do. We need to put in the kind of work and dedication that the Buddha did. If we imagine, it's so easy for awakening not to be present in this world. It's so very, very easy for these qualities of awakening not to be present. And it puts quite a responsibility on those people who have met them and who have met a teaching that enables us to realize them. There's no point being a vicarious spiritual practitioner, admiring from the sidelines and feeling okay about ourselves because we are associated with such a noble enterprise. We really do need to replicate the effort of the Buddha. But at the same time, we can't pump up some sort of artificial intensity either, at least not for very long. We've got to find ways to extend and keep on extending ourselves in a sustainable way, which means finding ways to keep on reconnecting to our sources of inspiration, which almost certainly mean being in contact with a Sangha somewhere or another. Okay, that's all from me. I'd like to finish with some words from Shantideva. I'd just like to remind you that I don't want applause, but please set yourself up just to sit for about 5 minutes comfortably, in which you can sit, absorb, have your own thoughts and feelings. So these are the words from the Bodhicharya-vatara that for me evoke a kind of ecstatic rejoicing in the majesty of the Bodhicitta. Just as a blind man may find by chance a priceless jewel in a heap of refuse, so somehow this Bodhi spirit is hidden even in me. It is the elixir of life, which destroys death, the destroyer of all. A limitless treasure to destroy all poverty. It is the supreme cure for the world's sickness. It is a tree of rest for the wearied world, wandering on the road of being. It is a bridge for all travellers, passing over the waters of suffering. It is the heart's waxing moon, cooling the heat of passion. It is a great sun, dispelling the darkness of the world's ignorance. It is fresh butter, churned from the milk of the true Dharma. For the caravan of famished beings, blundering on the road of existence, it is a banquet of joy, which refreshes completely all who hunger for happiness. Today I invite the world to Buddhahood, and to all the happiness of the Dharma. May gods, titans, and all rejoice.